the purpose of a business is to create value for a customer. So value is an experience that meets your expectations of better well-being. And so if you can run a firm on that basis, you can, as Jeff Bezos says, work backwards from the customer, build the infrastructure to address that need, and then the market rewards you.
Welcome to the Learn It All podcast with your hosts, Learn It CEO Damon Lemby and SVP of Product Darren Bridget. Our mission is to explore how continuous growth shapes the path to success. Our guests are high achievers who've learned there's always something new to discover. They'll share their stories, strategies, and insights with you. So whether you're a budding entrepreneur, a seasoned executive, an aspiring athlete, or simply someone who believes in the lifelong pursuit of knowledge, this podcast is for you. Join us now for the latest episode as we continue the Learn It All's journey through a world that never stops teaching.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Learn It All podcast. Here you go. In 2022, a shocking poll revealed that only 40% of young people today support capitalism. What's driving this generational shift? Let's find out today. We are Damon Lemby, CEO of Learn It, Darren Bridget, Chief Learning Architect at Learn It, and we are joined by Hunter Hastings. Hunter is an economist, a venture capitalist. He's published 5 books on marketing, service business strategies. He is the host of the Value Creators podcast, and today we're going to get into one of those books in particular, Aberrant Capitalism, The Decline of Customer Capitalism. Hunter, welcome to the show.
Hi, Darren. Hi, Damon. It's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, we're really happy. I have to say, you did a podcast with Damon not so long ago, and it was one of my favorite podcasts that Damon was on because you asked questions that were so smart, I actually feel a little intimidated right now.
Well, it's one of our highest rated episodes, so Damon was the star.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, good. Very diplomatic, too. All right, Hunter, here's the question just to get us started. I just gave a very brief intro. Could you tell us a little bit about your background?
Yeah, so as you say, I'm an economist in the sense that that was my education. My professional track was marketing primarily, first with Procter & Gamble, which makes household products, and then in various consulting industries. I found my way to Silicon Valley to lead a startup in marketing automation back in the days when we thought that if you put enough people, money, and computers in a room, you could solve any problem. And that was fine until 2000. It was a bit of a crash, but we exited. We made a corporate sale, and then I started my own consulting company on the subject of global branding, which was hot stuff back in the, you know, the end of the 20th century and the early 21st. And then I became a venture capitalist. I joined a venture capital fund called Biala Venture Partners, which is seed stage, which means that the entrepreneur has a business model, but it's not quite yet proven in the marketplace. So you're funding the scaling and the proof and the learning, to put it in your terminology, that will get you to the next level. So that's been great fun. We've had a lot of success.
Hunter, it's great to have you here today. Talk to me a little bit about what inspired you to write your newest book, Aberrant Capitalism.
Well, as Darren pointed out, young people are starting to lose trust and faith in capitalism, or at least the polling says so. So that data that you talked about was from a 2022 Pew poll. And as you say, more young people express a favorable idea about socialism than about capitalism. So how can that be? It's kind of counterfactual, because capitalism is the economic system that has raised so many people worldwide out of poverty and into higher levels of not only per capita income, but also well-being. So why are these young people seeing it this way? And when you dig a little deeper, what they're complaining about is corporations. So trust in corporations in similar polls is at a very low level. Trust in what they call small business is actually pretty high. It's up in the 80s and 90s in percentage terms. So what they're complaining about is corporations. And why is that? And we can get to the punchline because you and I talk about the same issue. It's about corporations losing empathy. And so we embarked on this history, starting with the invention of the corporation, which was a fabulous innovation in its time. So we start in about the second half of the 19th century with the Standard Oil and Quaker Oats and Singer sewing machine, all of the corporations that introduced mass marketing, mass production, mass distribution at a time when the population was expanding and had lots of new needs. So one of my favorites is Standard Oil, which the yellow press calls robber barons. John D. Rockefeller was a robber baron. But in fact, what he did was brought affordable illumination to the people in the American states and also eventually in Europe who needed light. They needed light to work in the evenings, to play with their kids, to educate their kids, to just continue life after it got dark. So that's just one example of increased well-being while driving the price down. The price of kerosene came down 1,000% over the short period of time. So, you know, true value, better life at a lower cost. So these were great entrepreneurs. These are individuals who saw this need and acted to meet it. What happens is that the entrepreneurs leave, they die or they retire, and management takes over. And the story of the 21st century is that the 20th century, I should say, is that the management started to have different goals than the entrepreneurs. And those goals were control. They were consistency and planning and those kinds of things. They created hierarchical organizations where people took orders, like the military. And that eventually became bureaucracy. And bureaucracy is just the enemy of value creation. It's not good for anybody, the people who work in it or the people who are customers of a bureaucracy. And then finally, just I'll get through the story very quickly. There was another twist at the end of the 20th century, which we call financialization. This idea that the purpose of the corporation is not to maximize customer value, but to maximize shareholder value. And what happens there is you start to focus on benefits for a narrow sliver of the population. Let's call it the financial sector. And it's, you know, boils down to a few big banks and the BlackRocks and so on of the world. And they're calling the shots at these corporations more so than the customer is calling the shots. Now, obviously, the corporations need the revenue. So they solve problems to talk about that, and they get revenue for doing so, but they lose this empathy with the customer, letting the customer drive. So that's a long story compressed into a short period of time for today, but there's hope, and that is that the new business models feature a direct connection to the customer. And one of the heroes here is Jeff Bezos, who talks about working backwards from the customer. What does the customer need? And then can I reverse engineer that into a product that helps them with that need? And he's always been a thought leader. He's gone as the CEO now, and we'll see if Amazon carries on that way. But the hope of the modern age and the hope for entrepreneurs everywhere is that this direct connection to the customer becomes the data that drives value creation. We have a whole new value creation engine. So that's the exciting part.
So how would you explain the concept of customer capitalism?
That the purpose of a business is to create value for a customer. So value is an experience that meets your expectations of better well-being. And so if you can run a firm on that basis, you can, as Jeff Bezos says, work backwards from the customer, build the infrastructure to address that need. And then the market rewards you. The market is a reputation machine. You know, you have to maintain your reputation. We call those brands. It's a improvement machine because there's always competition to improve the customer's well-being. And to a certain extent, it's a financial machine. You've got to make a profit to reinvest that into innovation and so on. So it's a flow backwards from the customer. I really like that image. Whereas a corporate capitalist approach is from the producer outwards. How can I build the factory? How can I get the product into the marketplace? How can I set my prices in a way that makes me a markup that becomes a profit? It's all a flow towards the customer. And customer capitalism is the reverse flow. It's a flow from the customer. The customer has all the energy, all the power, all the influence. The customer drives value. That's the difference.
And in your book, and I think you talk about self-management and the concept of flow, right? Is that essentially what we're talking about here?
Yeah, so the book identifies the challenges that grew up with management all the time, over time, the top-down controls. And the employees in a company that have the most value based on that model that we just discussed are the ones closest to the customer. So how do I empower them? How do they get to gather the data from the customer? How do they get that to flow back through the corporation? How do they get it into the innovation department and the finance department and the customer service department and so on? And the best way to do that is self-management, turn them loose. And we're beginning to understand that better today. We think about teams, where you've got multiple individuals working together to help create value for customers, as opposed to divisions and hierarchies and so on. And this direct connection to the customer that I talked about enables that self-management, because the data flows in and the people who see it first are the ones closest to the customer and are working on that customer satisfaction issue. So I think self-management is the future and no management is the way that the old hierarchical corporations will go.
It seems surprising to hear somebody who does venture capital to be critical of management, because I think that that's your guarantee with an investment of money, that if the company's being well managed, you're in good shape. But let's get into what you mean about management more specifically, because I'm sure you have an answer. And I wanted to look at a little bit the history that you talk about, because you're championing this idea of customer focused capitalism instead of thinking about shareholders and you know, managerial capital, and it's this entrepreneurial ethic is the thing that was a good track until we got sidetracked with corporations and this managerial efficiency attitude, and you have a very interesting timeline for that, but when I read about it, it was a little bit confusing, because if I go back to Henry Ford, you know, before the World War and Taylorism, I mean, that was all pretty early 20th century. Still kind of overlap with Robert Barron. I mean, when did the managerial efficiency take over and start to really ruin? Because I think of the Industrial Revolution as really thinking about people as cogs in a machine. That seemed very managerial.
That's a big part of it. You mentioned Taylorism, and Taylorism, the ghost of Taylorism still walks, Darren.
He's still
around, where you reduce people to the role of machines. How quickly and efficiently can I do this particular task or job, and then how can I link it to others and get to the final output? So that's about control. Mm-hmm. It looks at people as a cost, right? We're thinking of people as a very variable cost. And that became very sophisticated, what they called in the second half of the 20th century, strategic planning. So you put a fancy term on it. That's people at the center trying to control what the people at the interface with the customer are doing. How much time they spend on the phone, for example. That was a famous controversy in customer service terms, where the efficient manager says, reduce the length of the phone call as much as possible because that reduces costs. What that means is that the customer service rep is fobbing off the customer. They don't want to talk to them. It'd be much better to extend the length of that phone call, improve the relationship, and have a better kind of experience for the customer. So that's a good example. And management still looks at things that way. But there's opposite ways to do it. So one of the famous consultants of the latter half of the 20th century was Peter Drucker, and he preached the gospel that the only purpose of a customer, of a company, is to create a customer and then keep a customer. That's not about efficiency. You can always figure out how to manage costs later on. The customer decides what they'll pay, and then you decide what the costs are to implement that value. So management has always been about control, reducing costs, efficiency, and there's a role for that. I mean, we don't want to waste, but it's not about focusing on customers, not about empathy. It's not about change when the customer changes. So you talked about entrepreneurship. When we look at entrepreneurs, when we put money into a company at the seed stage, the one thing you know is that it's going to change, that the business model has some unexplored parts in it that needs to be adjusted, it needs to be adaptive. And so an entrepreneur is somebody who can make that change, can make that switch, can come back to the venture capitalist and say, hey, you invested in this business model, but it turns out to be the wrong one. We're going to go this other way based on what we're hearing from customers. So management is a horrible thing to impose upon an entrepreneur. Now, when a company gets big, you've got to be able to do both. We call it being ambidextrous. You've got to manage for efficiency once you've figured out the value proposition. But that can't be the leading role for a corporation. Entrepreneurship has to be the leading role.
I like that. You know, I was just, this reminds me a little bit, Hunter, I was just having a conversation with a gentleman, a VC, and he was talking about a previous organization he worked for where they had the ability to hire some of the top talent from Harvard, from Princeton, wherever they considered like the smartest people in the world. But the problem is they'd hire them, they'd put them in and they'd put them in a box and they really controlled what they were capable of doing. And one of the reasons why he left that firm was he's like, because we're wasting the talent and the ability because management wanted to control what people have to say and to do.
Yeah, and that's true of, you know, we complain a little bit about MBAs, kind of the A, they teaching business administration, how to manage the business, as opposed to what we would like to teach, which is a master's of business entrepreneurship. How do you keep the entrepreneurial ethic, as you call it, which is a great term, in a larger corporation? We saw that problem with engineers a lot. Engineers are wonderful people. They're creative. They write great lines of code. But if they can't see the customer, if they can't think about the customer, if they can't empathize with the customer, then that code is not going to be as effective or as valuable as it could be. And so it's the customer experience through the code. And that's what we have to solve for, to get both of those things together. Write great code that gives great experience.
Hunter, I almost feel like you're a marketer in that Christensen way, masquerading as an economist.
I think that's true. But the two functions in a corporation that Peter Drucker talked about that we named were innovation and marketing. Mm-hmm. And in my brand of economics, it is marketing. So if you understand value, that value is subjective. That's the fancy term for it in economics. That means it's in the customer's head. That means you have to empathize with them, get inside their head to understand that. And then you've got to build the infrastructure, the companies, the services that address that need, that requirement for value. So that is economics. Now, economics went the same way as management in the 20th century. It became mathematicized, it became top-down, it became government economics, as I call it. You know, we think we can tweak this lever, the money supply or government spending or something to get a better outcome. That's got nothing to do with customers and well-being. So I think economics went the same way as management, in the wrong direction.
Hunter, prior to coming on stage today, so to speak, we spoke about problem, solution, and really what we should be talking about is need. And can you share a little bit about what you mean? And I really like the example about the mom story you told.
Yeah, so it's a mechanical way of approaching things to say we're problem solution. What problem does the customer have? Now there's some merit in that. They want to solve a problem. But as you made reference to, I grew up in consumer packaged goods. My customer was mom, and the problem we were solving was cleanliness in laundry, getting shirts whiter and brighter and smelling better and all those other kinds of things. So that was a problem to solve in that sense. You know, the clothes weren't as white as they could be. And mom may have been aware of that, that she may have had that functional point of view. But what she's trying to do is be a better mom. That's her need. She wants to be the best that she can. She wants to be the mom of the family that wants to be proud when her husband goes to the office. She wants to feel good that her husband can be proud of how he's dressed. The kids are looking good when they go to school. That's about being a good mom. And that's, you know, I'm generalizing for a consumer issue. But if you, my job was to understand mom. What does mom feel about washing? How does it fit into her life? How does she fit it in between groceries and the office and everything like that? And how can I make her feel better about it? So problem solving has a role, but it's a mechanical view of the world. And what we're trying to achieve is this empathic view of what do customers feel? And that's true of business to business in this high technology world, just as much as it is of consumers. You know, is my office running well? Are my people having the best possible productivity tools? Is their state of mind such that they'll be working hard and be collaborative and those kinds of things? So it's this feeling, identifying feelings of value, that's the skill, that's the need.
It's kind of amazing, going back to the title of your book, Aberrant Capitalism, that I just assume capitalism is so much qualitative, it's numbers and things, but it's kind of like you're saying it's aberrant because it's lost its humanity and its empathy. But then the thought that I have there, because we talk about the real issue that a lot of people have is with corporations, not with capitalism moving forwards. And we're treating corporations like people legally, but a corporation by definition doesn't have empathy. Like, isn't that like, how do you square that?
Well, you're right. The corporation is a legal entity, and that's been a functional benefit to society, as we talked about, the ability to achieve the kinds of scale that it can achieve. But it's also, at the same time, and more importantly, a nexus of relationships. And so we should think about capitalism as relationships. So we're talking about the relationship of the customer with the corporation. And the corporation is just a bunch of people. And you know, they come together with hopefully a shared purpose, and they collaborate in order to bring value to the customer. I'd be happy in a world, Darren, where there were no numbers in that sense, that it is all qualitative. Now, in accounting, you get to the numbers in retrospect. So the numbers are a result. So I please the customer. Mm-hmm. The customer's willing to pay. That comes to me as cash flow. I've got some costs. I do the accounting. It's after the fact. What we do wrong with numbers is plan the future. I must hit this quarterly earnings target. I must sell 1.7 million units. And then you start to get into that mechanical business of forgetting the customer and what the customer wants and you know, incentivizing the sales force. So one of the great examples we had just recently, I probably over a year old now, but Wells Fargo Bank. Their job is to facilitate the customer's financial life. And they thought that, hey, we can do that if we open lots of different service accounts. They can have credit cards, they can have checking, they can have all kinds of other things. So they provided a numerical incentive to the sales force. The more accounts per customer you get, the bigger your bonus. The sales force started to create fake accounts. They didn't tell the customer they created fake accounts. And that's because they were driven by a number, open more accounts, not a qualitative goal, facilitate the customer's life in a better way. So that was a very stark example, I think.
In your book, Hunter, you say one of the big twists, and you touched on it a little bit, but I'm hoping you could maybe explain for our audience, is financialization.
Yes, so there's set of data from the Bank of International Settlements, which is actually the biggest central bank in the world, the Central Bank of Central Banks. It says if the financial sector gets bigger, the productive economy serving customers gets smaller and starts to decline and fail. And that's because it's diverting value from the customer to the financial sector. And so, again, the customer is the customer is still willing to pay. They're providing cash flow to the corporation. But the corporation extracts that value and provides it to a small sliver of the population, the financial sector, as dividends and earnings, and the worst of all is stock buybacks. And so the people are trying to please are no longer the customers so much as the financial sector. And they start to impose conditions on that company. It's where we get a lot of the pressure for these ESG rules and the DEI rules. It's coming from the financial sector. It's draining the value from customers and re-diverting it to a narrow sliver of individuals. So financialization, maximizing shareholder value, became the mantra of corporations instead of maximizing customer value. We can still make profits. We can still reward our shareholders, but we can't make that the primary focus. It's got to be an outcome, a result of creating customer value, not the purpose that replaces customer value.
And the buybacks, I assume, I think from my research, is because that money should be pumped into R&D, right?
Well, exactly. So we have some examples in the book where companies use more than 100% of the net earnings that they make in a year in the form of dividends and buybacks, i.e. giving it to the shareholders. Now, that in the capitalist world, that revenue should be plowed back into R&D and new projects that are long-term, uncertain. We're not sure what's going to happen, but it's for the benefit of customers. If they're buying back shares, then they're not investing in that kind of experimental innovation and R&D. So it's again, the customer who pays the price.
Hunter, such fascinating stuff. I mean, it's even more surprising conversation than I expected to have. As you paint this picture of where we've fallen, we're paying attention to the wrong things. You know, it's like the wrong things are in charge, like the financial markets and things like that. And we need to flip it back to the customer, and we need to really re-inject empathy back into how we think about business and economies. How do we do that? I assume maybe there's a business education component to that. Like what's the future? It's certainly not going back to Robert Barron times. Exactly. Like, right. What is the future?
Well, there's two parts to, I think. One is understanding economics in a better way. And I know that's not family dinner table conversation, but it's what drives a lot of corporations now. And the economics we have is misplaced. It's about this. We can plan the economy. We can turn this dial and the output will go up. Whereas the economics that I think is much better is it's about the customer. It's about feelings. It's qualitative, as you said, Darren. It's subjective. So how do we understand that as economics? And then how do we translate that into corporate operations that delivers the goods and services to the customers as they want them? So it's a qualitative mindset, not a quantitative mindset. You still got to do the accounting. Mm-hmm. So it's changing the way of thinking. We're all taught to focus on math and calculation and mechanics and engineering and so on, all of which are important. But there's a cultural focus on subjective quality experience, the love of life, which, you know, economics doesn't really capture very well. So I think it's a cultural transformation, but economics has a big part to play.
Talking about changing the way of thinking, how about changing the way business education is run? Can you talk a little bit about that? And then I'd like to get into your online courses that you just produced.
Yeah, so the one way that the current situation that we've just described came about is business education. And part of that is is formal, and the MBA and business courses, they've been around since the late 19th century, but it's teaching financial management, spreadsheet management, operational efficiency, all of those things, really important. But it doesn't teach this customer value creation in the same way that we'd like it to be taught. And so we think there's an opportunity for reform there. And to Darren's point, it would start with understanding value. What is value? It's a subjective feeling that the customer has. Well, how do I figure that out? Well, that's empathy. Empathy is a business tool. Then how do I bring that to the customer? That's design as a process. So there's actually a lot of good work going on in design that's driven by the customer. And then how do I innovate? How do I keep getting better? So innovation management's a big part. One of the problems with corporations that we tracked in the book, Damon, is that they have been wonderfully innovative, and then they seek to lock it in. They seek to protect it. So they don't innovate into the future. And then thinking about organization in different ways, we like to think of the corporation as a flow as opposed to a hierarchy or a set of divisions that are managed from the top. And how do we turn people loose at the periphery, as we talked about, the ones closer to the customer? So we think we can teach all of that as principles, and then individuals will apply those principles in running the business. Now we also have to do our accounting, so that's part of the education. So the vision is, let's have a different kind of business school. My mental model is the Masters of Business Entrepreneurship. And entrepreneurship is this universal function, what you call the entrepreneurial ethic, Damon, that my job is to serve the customer, to make their lives better, and I'll be rewarded by the market. As opposed to a Masters of Business Administration, which is about the spreadsheets and the finances and the operations and the efficiency. So that's the goal. And we've just launched our first mini step, if you like. It's the online Value Creators course. You can find it at thevaluecreators.com. And one of the things we're going to do is learn, is we'll let people go through the course. We'll listen to their feedback. We'll see what their comments are, and we'll continue to improve. So we've got a number of business professors teaching some of the principles and a number of business practitioners teaching the experiential learning and action part. And what we hope to do is embed that in corporations, have corporations use it as part of their management training, so that experiential learning takes place inside the corporation, not in the business school. So we're just starting the journey.
Can you give us an example of how that could work, where it's embedded into the managerial training?
Well, I think it goes through HR initially. So it's going to come from the CEO and the C-suite to say, this is who we are. This is our philosophy. This is our orientation. This is our commitment. And then education can be consumed informally inside the corporation. You know, maybe it's lunch and learns. You're the experts on learning inside the corporation. In fact, I should take your advice about how best to do that. But make it informal, make it easy to consume on the desktop. Make it a discussion group that says, how can we apply this? You talk all the time about learning groups and adaptive learning and active learning. We've got to find the right ways to do that. So embedding the principles in the most easy to consume way possible, and we're saying that's online, and then making it experiential through application. How could we actually use this to change what we're doing at the corporation? So we've got a number of corporations who are thinking about starting this route, and we hope to continue down that path.
Hunter, I get afraid that where we're heading in this uncertain future with large language models and the GPTs, the generative artificial intelligence, that the work that gets replaced is the knowledge worker, like the people that are doing the kind of thing you're talking about, which is thinking about how can we innovate, how can we create more value, and what will be left is more of just a little bit more just, you know, cogs in a machine. Are we heading to a future that will give us increase our humanity, our contribution in organizations, or is it going to be in conflict with each other?
Well, I'm an optimist on that front, Darren, although clearly we don't know at this point. We embrace the uncertainty. But here's what I think. It's a wonderful time for entrepreneurs and for human values, because technology has built us these great platforms on which the entrepreneur can add the layer of value. So Amazon's a great example of that, right? They've got all kinds of ways to help small retailers sell to customers, get data, improve their offerings, improve their pricing, and so on. It's a platform on which the entrepreneur can work. And I think that AI has the potential to go that way. So the large language models become platforms. As long as they're not made proprietary, they're not hard to access, they're open source, we can all build on those. And then we'll build our own entrepreneurial layer. And it'll be actually smarter for entrepreneurship than ever before. I can know you because I'm getting data about you. I can learn your preferences. I can try out different approaches on you. I can find out what you need. And I think the AI will help us to understand need. And then I can build the delivery of a service for that need on top of the large language model. So that's what I think will happen. I think it's going to be actually a great time for entrepreneurship. I think the structure of business will change because lots of companies can build on that platform, not just the largest ones. So the big ones build the AI, but hopefully that's accessible to all to build on this additional layer of entrepreneurial value creation. That's my hope.
I like what you said there. And I agree. I think this almost levels the playing field a little bit for the smaller organizations who can get in, who maybe don't have the massive R&D budget, but they can get in with the AI to elevate their organizations, which before they didn't have that opportunity.
Right. And the great capital there is human capital, because it's, you know, at this stage, it's how you write the prompt, how you have the conversation with the LLM, right? And what value you can identify in that, and how you can build on it, how you can improve it. It's individuation. Every conversation with ChatGPT is individuated. So every run is unique, and that's how value is created. So I'm a big optimist and fan of where that could lead us.
Hunter, I got one last quick question. Hopefully, can you help me win an argument? I'll get into arguments with some of my financial friends about, you know, this idea that business is about maximizing value for shareholders. And I want to make the case that it should be Drucker's point, that it should be about getting and creating a customer. Can you give me what's my bullet points for winning that argument?
Well, that the most valuable companies in the world today actually display a greater ability to serve customer needs than the old companies that we wrote about in a lot of the books. So I've mentioned Amazon a couple of times before. They create customer value. If you read Jeff Bezos's first shareholder letter, that's what it's about. He says, we're going to serve the customer. We're not going to serve shareholders. We may not even make a profit for a long time. We're going to reinvest in serving the customer. And we're going to have a long-term point of view. And so that was established as the new norm for these big corporations. I think a lot of Apple and a lot of Google has been that way. It's enabling us to create value. Now, the challenge is that the financial bureaucracy and the compliance bureaucracy comes in and they throttle that. So it's a constant fight. But I do think that this direct connection to the customer is creating this new opportunity, and it shows up in stock market values. You look at the 5-year total shareholder return of companies like Apple and Amazon and Netflix and so on. They're outperforming as a result of this direct connection. So the shareholder value is a consequence still. It's an outcome. It's a residual, but it's not the purpose.
So Hunter, we have a signature question that we asked typically near the end. But before I get to that, we've talked about a lot, but is there anything that we haven't spoken about today that you want to talk about?
Well, no, I'm very happy that you've asked the questions the way you have and supported some of the ideas that we're pursuing. Another time we might talk about economics, because there's several flavors of economics, as we've hinted at, and I'm a fan of some of them and not the others. But no, I think if we can get across this idea of capitalism as a positive producer of well-being for customers that makes a profit as it does so, that we can get that word across to the whole world, that we can get these 18 to 29-year-olds to realize that, hey, capitalism is helping me and I can help it, and I should participate. That's the good goal, I think.
All right, Hunter, so here we go. What is one thing, our listeners have gotten to know you a little bit, what is one thing about you that would surprise our listeners? You know, we've had people come on and say that they, you know, Darren always likes to say that they're a surprise, they're an undercover Trekkie, or they studied, I don't know,
meteorology. We had a closet meteorologist once. That was surprising.
I am an addicted fan of soccer, specifically the English Premier League, and specifically Newcastle United, which is the team in the town closest to where I was born. There's a super interesting element, which we'll just touch on, but they've just been acquired by the PIF, the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia, which is a great example of capitalism helping consumers by making my Newcastle United team better and more entertaining and better able to win the Premier League. So that's my addiction. I'm up at 4:30 on a Friday morning or a Saturday morning here in San Diego to listen to the English Premier League on TV.
That's great. Have you been watching Welcome to Wrexham?
Yeah, I love that. I think that's fabulous.
It's terrific, isn't it?
Another piece of capitalism at work, Darren.
Yeah, I know, right? And it's like you like. Well, Hunter, it was really fabulous to have you on the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, you're a great host. I'm a big fan of yours, Darren, but also of Damon, since I've known him before I met you, and the whole Learn It approach, the learning company, becoming a learning company. I wrote a blog post, Damon, after we talked, which is every company should become a learning company, but it's not that easy.
I'll send it to you.
But yeah. You're inspiring, and I think learning is very, very much a qualitative, subjective approach. How can I learn better about the customer? So I love what you do. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, speaking of learning, I think we learned a lot today about the value creation approach to economies, to the world, to your own businesses. What I learned, I think, is that 40% of young people, they're not necessarily wrong in that we've kind of lost our direction. Maybe not even necessarily just corporations, but we have to, there's a real need to bring empathy and reshift our focus when it comes to business more towards this entrepreneurial approach. A big shout out and thank you to everyone who tuned in today. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe and tell your friends. And remember to stay curious and keep learning. Thanks, everyone, for being with us today.
Have a good day, everyone.
Thank you.